Friday, once again.
Another one rolls around.
Here come the weekend. Time for American Hit Radio on 90.3 WHBC. Thanks for coming along with us, folks. On Fridays, we changed the topic to How Music Changed. You must know this by now. Where we have 250 specific topics where we're trying to cover as much as we can about the history of recorded music, all the highlights and the best bits. We're doing this by focusing on the most important record labels, the most important artists, most important songwriters.
Nothing but the best for you.
That's right. Or maybe in sometimes in we'll get an entire period of time from a specific angle. And a few weeks back, we started a series dedicated to certainly one of the premier artists of the 20th century. When I say premier, I mean, if I only have five fingers on my one hand, I would definitely count him in the top five of the 20th century. Maybe you could even cut a couple off and I'd still count them. It's Duke Ellington. And we've done three shows already, Heidi, pretty remarkably. And the truth of the matter is this. If I want to present these shows in a strictly chronological manner, but there's a problem, you see. If we do that, and we want to cover his past, which of course we do, before he gets a recording contract, the entire show, the first show, would be nothing but talk without music. And I think that would have been pretty awful.
Yawn.
So we're putting the songs, you know, we're interspersing them with the story. And I'd say by about the end of this show, we might be even with the story versus the music. But we've already covered his early years. We've covered him coming to New York. Last week, we covered him and his engagement up at the Cotton Club. Mm-hmm. What I want to discuss mostly in today's program, Heidi, is his development as a songwriter and as an arranger. He very quickly became one of the most important and influential writers, arrangers of, I guess, really of the 20th century. And this is the show where we're going to start to see that happen. Ellington was the first one to be essentially to introduce the long form to jazz, where he was going to basically take themes. And in the 78 RPM era, it was a very risky thing to do, very sure. Artistic step, where he was pretty much pushing jazz towards something that was a little bit more European in context. Just like classical music would have sections that could be, you know, 10, 15 minutes long, Ellington started to think in those terms. So we're going to be getting to that. But we're going to start with from his book, which is called Music Is My Mistress, some of his, which is his own memoir. We'll cover some highlights of him in his time in New York, and we'll intersperse that with a few of the songs that were from the 1929 to, say, 1931 era, which is what we're up to musically. Here he talks about Bricktop. Bricktop was the famous French nightclub ingenue, who also became pretty famous here in New York. Have you ever heard of her?
No.
Never heard of Bricktop?
No.
Oh, how about that? She's worth looking up because she was one of the first people to develop an international welcoming of jazz players.
Okay.
Very famous in that sense. So here he is talking about Bricktop. Bricktop, incidentally, knew us in Washington, D.C. She had worked with us in the Oriental Gardens, a place owned by Lewis Thomas, one of my original employers. Bricktop thought we were very nice kids. There were five of us: Sonny Greer, Elmer Snowden, Arthur Wetzel, Otto Hardwick, and myself. Did I mention that Bricktop is a woman?
I think you did. Well, I think you may have said she.
Okay, just to make sure that should be understood. Okay.
You mentioned her pronoun.
When she heard that we were unemployed in New York, she insisted that Baron hire us immediately, and that he did. Mr. Baron Wilkins was a beautiful man. He had lots of money, but he never hustled a customer. Of course, that was the general spirit of those times. People in that life did not so readily underestimate others, and for young kids like us, they had many suggestions for ways to get along in the world. I shall never forget Bricktop's speech. "You know that you kids are making your living on tips," she said. The salary was $50 a week, but tips at around $1,000 a night, split nine ways, averaged over a C-note a day for each person. "Always remember it," she continued, "and always be generous when tipping, because the man who depends mostly upon tips for a living is one of us, and our people are always generous when we tip." Good advice, Bricktop. Okay, let's play a song then that Ellington recorded around this era, a song called Oklahoma Stop, a personal favorite of mine, if not particularly famous, but a great track nonetheless, on 90.3 WHPC. I love that track because I think it's a great example of late 20s, early 30s.
Oh, it's so lively.
Jazz, yeah. It's you're beginning to hear like the birth of swing, but yeah, it's really lively, really upbeat. You get the sort of the whole flapper image and everything else.
Oh, yeah.
It's really excellent at conveying exactly what jazz sounded like at the time and how easily Ellington adapted to it. And how good he was at adapting to it as well. Keep that in mind, though, as the show progresses and watch what happens as he himself begins to change the whole face of music. Okay, in this next instance, I'm going to read an excerpt. This is about him meeting Fats Waller, if I'm on the right page, which I'm not.
Fix that.
Fats Waller came to Washington in the spring of 1923 and played for Clarence Robinson in a burlesque show at the Gaiety Theater. Sonny Greer, Toby Hardwick, and I had gotten to know him well when we were in New York with Sweatman. So now we had a chummy exchange. "I'm quitting next week," Fats said. "Why don't you all come up to New York and take the job? I'll tell him about you." We jumped at the opportunity.
Woo-hoo.
And we're all on edge until the time came to go. Sonny and Toby, which is out of Hardwick, went ahead of me by a few days. When I called to find out if everything was straight, they assured me that it was. Everything's okay, they said. Don't worry about nothing, man. Because I had a gig waiting for me, I felt entitled to travel in style. I hopped a train, took a parlor car, ate a big, expensive dinner in the diner, and got a cab to Pennsylvania Station to take me uptown.
Wow.
With these expenses and tips in proportion, I had spent all my money by the time I reached 129th Street.
Oh, boy.
Sonny Greer was waiting, and the first thing he said as he opened the cab door for me was, "Duke, buddy, give us something. We're all busted and waiting for you to relieve the situation."
Uh-oh.
By something, he meant money.
I know.
But it was too late. "Sorry, man, I'm broke too," I said. "I blew it all on the trip up from Washington." Everything had gone wrong and there was no job.
What?
Yet there were friends waiting to help us and to show me the way. Willie the Lion Smith was one of them. And Freddie Guy used to let us sit in for him at the Orient and, most important, split the tips. It was a very hot summer, and I remember how we had to ride that subway every morning to get downtown to audition in the Strand building where nearly all the agents seemed to be. We had no luck there, and it was Bricktop, the famous Bricktop, Ada Smith is her real name, who finally pulled us out of the hole we were in. The Washingtonians were different, his original band, in several ways. We paid quite a lot of attention to our appearance, and if any one of us came in dressed improperly, Wetzel, the trumpet player, would flick his cigarette ash in a certain way or pull down the lower lid of his right eye with his forefinger and stare at the offending party. Wetzel was our first unofficial disciplinarian, and he carried himself with dignity befitting a medical student of lofty ambitions. His tonal character, fragile and genteel, was an important element in our music. As a result of playing all those society dances in Washington, we had learned to play softly, which is what is sometimes known as under-conversation music.
Uh-huh.
We did cover last week examples of Ellington being able to play sweet jazz versus the harder stuff.
That's one thing you never learned to play.
The softer stuff.
Yeah.
The under-conversation.
Yes.
Oh, yes, I did. Not right away, though. But here is, that being said, a very poor example of under-conversation music by Duke Ellington and his orchestra. This song is called Jazz Lips on American at Radio 90.3 WHPC. not exactly under conversation music, but not quite as crazy hot as the first number. All right, so we'll tell a few more stories about how he basically got his footing. During my first few months in New York, I found out that anybody was eligible to take songs into the music publishers on Broadway. So I joined the parade and teamed up with Joe Trent, a nice guy who was familiar with the routines of the publishing world. He liked my music and he was a good lyricist, so he took my hand and guided me around Broadway. We wrote several songs together and auditioned every day in one publisher's office or another, and, as was normal, had practically no success.
Yeah.
Imagine Duke Ellington, like, you know, this is how hard the music business was then. 100 years later, it's so much worse. Until one day when we demonstrated a song for Fred Fisher. He was not only a publisher, but a wonderful songwriter himself. He wrote Chicago, and he was always an inspiration to me. "I like it," he said, after listening to our song. "I'll take it." "You know, of course, that we want a $50 advance," Joe said. "Okay," Fred Fisher replied. "Give me a lead sheet, and I'll sign the contract." "Give the man a lead sheet," Joe said, turning to me. I had never made a lead sheet before, nor tried to write music of any kind. But it was 4:30 p.m., and I knew the checkbook would be closed at 5. So, in spite of 10 pianos banging away in 10 different booths, I sat down and made a lead sheet. It was satisfactory. We got the money, split it, and then split the scene.
What is a lead sheet?
Well, you basically write down the melody on a line and the chord changes along with the lyrics, so that you could write sheet music for the song.
Oh.
Basically the idea.
There you go.
I had broken the ice and at the same time gotten hooked on writing music. One more track. All right, this time we'll be playing Double Check Stomp on Americanet Radio 90.3 WHPC. Thank you. I should probably talk about all the players on that track.
Okay.
Because the band is just so awesome at this time. And there's a few surprises as well, as you may have heard. The band that was credited to the Jungle Band. We'll talk about that a little bit more, or Duke will, as we read on. But the band at this point in time had three trumpet players: Arthur Wetzel, who we had learned about a little bit earlier, Cootie Williams, and Freddie Jenkins. There were two trombonists, Joe Nanton and Juan Tizol. There were three players that would play clarinet or a sax, depending on what the song called for, which was Barney Bogard, Johnny Hodges, and Harry Carney, each of who were multi-instrumentalists. Duke, of course, on piano. Fred Guy played banjo. And you may have noticed that there was a guy named Cornell Smeltzer who played accordion on that track. Then there was Wilman Brout, who was playing the stand-up bass, and Sonny Greer on drums. Pretty significant and a big band. You know, obviously, Duke's got the best of the best with the players. Okay. So, picking up where we were. It was at the Kentucky Club that our music acquired new colors and characteristics. First, we added Charlie Irvis, a trombone player nicknamed Plug, because of the unusual mute that he used. Then, when Artie Wetzel went back to Washington to continue his studies at Howard University, we got Bubber Miley, the epitome of soul, and a master with the plunger mute. Now, this is before, again, this is earlier than where we're at with our music. After Irvis left to join Charlie Johnson's band, Joe Tricky Sam Nanton came in, and he and Bubber became a great team, working hand in glove. Now, time to find a manager. My initial encounter with Irving Mills occurred during my first 6 months in New York. He was known as the last resort for getting some money by those who had been peddling songs all day without success. He used to come to the Kentucky Club often, and one night he said he didn't know what we were doing with their music, but he liked it and would like to record some of it with our band. We jumped at the chance, and this was really the beginning of a long and wonderful association. The procedure was usually the same. Have four numbers ready for recording at 9 a.m. tomorrow, he'd say. We'd do that, and he liked what we did, and interest grew. It was a very good thing for us. He had the contacts. I liked to write music and play it, too. The rather short time allotted didn't bother me, because I loved doing it. I just went ahead and did it. We seemed to be recording once a week, sometimes three or four times a week, sometimes with our regular group and sometimes with singers or other musicians, as you just heard. It didn't matter which to me because I was getting my kicks writing and recording, and some of the tunes were beginning to show up well in the sales department. All that activity was good for both Irving Mills and me because I was in the environment I wanted to live in, recalling some of our old licks and experiments with new ideas and devices. We recorded for almost every existing label under different names. I told you it was coming. Duke Ellington on Victor, the Jungle Band on Brunswick, the Washingtonians on Harmony, the Whoopee Makers on Perfect, Sonny Greer and his Memphis Men on Columbia, odd, the Harlem Footwarmers on OK, and so on. Most of the records were instrumentals, and they sold very well. One more track? Let's drop in a song called Old Man Blues on American at Radio, 90.3 WHPC. Thank you. was Old Man Blues, sort of like a mellow hot jazz track. Now is when our story starts to catch up to where we are musically.
Okay.
The next big step, this is, again, all words of Duke Ellington himself from his memoir, Music is My Mistress. The next big step was when we went into the Cotton Club on December 4, 1927. We had to audition for this job, but it called for a band of at least 11 pieces, and we had been only using six at the Kentucky Club. At the time, I was playing a vaudeville show for Clarence Robinson at Gibson Standard Theater on South Street in Philadelphia. The audition was set for noon, but by the time I had scraped up 11 men, it was 2 or 3 o'clock. We played for them and got the job. The reason for that was that the boss, Harry Block, didn't get there till late either and didn't hear the others. That's a classic example of being at the right place at the right time with the right thing before the right people. He was the luckiest man in the universe.
Very.
Constantly lucky. If you ask Irving Mills, he will most likely confess that he is the man who, one, there's eight of these here, insisted that I make and I record only my own music. Two, got me into the Cotton Club, the RKO Palace, and the Black and Tan fantasy movie. Three, had big fights with record companies to get the black artist into hitherto all white catalogs. Four, fought with the Dillingham executives to have us play in concert with Maurice Chevalier. Five, achieved our entry into picture houses, which we pioneered for big bands, regardless of race. Six, arranged our interstate tours of the South and Texas in our own Pullman cars. Seven, triumphantly secured my entrance into ASCAP, the publishing company. Eight, took us to Europe in 1933, where we played the London Palladium and met members of the British royal family on several occasions. Duke had really nothing bad to say about a manager that was able to help him break down all of those barriers. Although Duke was quite good at it himself.
Right.
Now here's where the change comes and where we catch up. Later that year in the fall, we had a six-piece recording date. Mills never lost his liking for the original small combo sound, even when the big band had made its mark. On this occasion, as usual, the night before was the time for me to write and think music. I already had three tunes, and while waiting for my mother to finish cooking dinner, I began to write a fourth. In 15 minutes, I wrote the score for Mood Indigo. We recorded it. And that night at the Cotton Club, when it was almost time for our broadcast, Ted Husing, the announcer, asked, "Duke, what are you going to play tonight?" I told him about the new number, and we played it on the air, six pieces out of the 11-piece band. The next day, wads of mail came in raving about the new tune. So Irving Mills put a lyric on it, and royalties are still coming in for my evening's work more than 40 years later. We've played a few massive hits by Duke already in this series, but this is the one that broke him wide open and the reason he became a national star and eventually an international star. The song Mood Indigo on American Hit Radio on 90.3 WHPC. Duke showing elements of his classicism right there. Stunning, amazing, like tonal bent notes. It's just, this is 1930, 31. It's just absolutely stunning.
Hmm.
This is now basically comments from Harvey G. Cohen, who wrote a book called Duke Ellington's America, because it was no accident that Ellington's first nationally distributed press manual appeared when it did. Mood Indigo, the band's most popular single yet, had been released at the end of 1930. As has been argued in Schutzen's study of marketing, sales cause advertising, not the other way around, as is sometimes surmised. The Ellington Orchestra had succeeded beyond all expectations during their period of test marketing from 1927 to 1931 at the Cotton Club and on national radio. With a national radio audience hungry to see the band in person and the enhanced emphasis on artistry outlined in their 1931 press manual, the economic incentive now existed to take the band to the next level in terms of lucrative national and international tours, appearances in films, and increased recognition of Ellington's composing prowess. That's what happens when you write a song as gorgeous as that. All right, here's what Ellington says on a much more simpler note, almost like, you know, basically working man's tone. Sunday night in the Cotton Club was the night. All the big New York stars in town, no matter where they were playing, showed up at the Cotton Club to take bows. Dan Healy was the man who staged the shows in our time, and on Sunday night, he was the MC who introduced the stars. Somebody like Sophie Tucker would stand up and we'd play her song, Some of These Days, and she, as she made her way up the floor for a bow, it was all done in pretty grand style. Harlem had a tremendous reputation in those days, and it was a very colorful place. It was an attraction, like Chinatown was in San Francisco.
Hmm.
When you go to New York, people said, you mustn't miss going to Harlem. The Cotton Club became famous nationally because of our transcontinental broadcast almost every night. A little later, something similar happened with Father Hines at the Grand Terrace in Chicago. But Harlem, the Cotton Club, was the top place to go.
Awesome.
Let's play two tracks from this era, songs that are representing both sides of the style some of the time. First is called Blue Again, and we'll follow that with Rockin' in Rhythm on AmericanNet Radio, 90.3 WHPC.
Thank you. Josh.
So at this point, Ellington has got songs which are becoming instant classics under his belt. Mood Indigo in particular, Rockin' and Rhythm, which we just heard, basically prompting Irving Mills to go hog wild with trying to figure out what he can do with this elegant black man who is really set to change history. So he enacted this new marketing strategy, stressing genius, respectability, and serious artistry through various measures in the early 1930s. Now, this is where we're going with this. In June 1931, which is the month that Ellington recorded the 8-minute plus Creole Rhapsody, his first extended composition, and probably the first original work by a popular composer to be issued on two different sides of a 78 RPM disc. By a Mills took out a full page ad in Variety, which was a rarity for a black act at the time. Rarer still, the ad, rather than heralding the release of Creole Rhapsody, instead heralded the vision of Ellington that Mills wished to present. It was image advertising, not product advertising, uncommon in popular music promotion at the time, but frequently used in corporate advertising. With its modernistic Art Deco design and tagline of Duke Ellington, America's new vogue, a different kind of music, the ad made the argument, as would dozens of ads from the Mills organization during the 1930s, that here was a popular music artist unlike any other, an artist whose talent would make fans and critics of popular American music revise their expectations of what the medium could deliver and encompass. Stunning, right? Again, a bit of a more plebeian view from Duke's viewpoint, who's in the middle of it. The episodes of the gangster era, this is Duke talking now, were never a healthy subject for discussion. People would ask me if I knew so-and-so. Hell no, I'd answer. I don't know him. The homicide squad would send for me every few weeks to go down. Hey, Duke, you didn't know so-and-so, did you? They would ask. No, I'd say, but I knew all of them because a lot of them used to hang out in the Kentucky Club. And by the time I got to the Cotton Club, things were really happening. I had some funny experiences in Chicago, too. It was in that city when we were playing the Oriental Theater that Irving Mills came to me one day with an original idea. He was always reaching toward a higher plateau for our music. Tomorrow is a big day, he said. We premiere a new long work, a rhapsody. Really? I replied. Okay. So I went out and wrote Creole Rhapsody. And I did so much music for it that we had to cut it up and do two versions. One came out on Brunswick and the other, longer one, on Victor. Irving almost blew his connection at both companies for recording a number that was not only more than 3 minutes long, but took both sides of the record. That was the seed from which all kinds of extended works and later suites grew. Here then, with the time that we've got, is the first of the two versions of Creole Rhapsody. It's so awesome that we will absolutely need to cover both in this show. On American Radio 90.3 WHPC, here is parts one and two of Creole Rhapsody number one. Thank you. All right. I hope you have good memories, because I want to play the second version of Creole Rhapsody parts 1 and 2, because it's so totally different from what we just heard, which you recorded for a different record label. But we're going to end rather quickly with Duke's version of a song called Limehouse Blues. I think you might know it by Django Reinhardt if you're a jazz fan. Duke made an arrangement for it for big band, and it's a perfect way to end today's show. On American Radio 90.3 WHPC, here's Duke Ellington and his orchestra performing Limehouse Blues, and we hope you will join us again, of course, next Friday as we continue our series. Take care, folks. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.